Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I'm your host, Johannes Koch, senior reporter at DebtWire. I'm pleased to have Chris Hall and Robert von Finkenstein from Interpath on the show today to talk about distress and restructuring in private credit. Chris is managing director at Interpath and has been a debt advisor for a number of years now and with Interpath for just over 2 years and is the lead on leverage finance for the UK. Prior to that, he also spent 7 years at Wyvern Partners, debt advisor at Boutique, and also at EY in other capacities. Robert is Interpath's head of debt advisory for the German-speaking region and has been covering mid-market private equity funds and Mittelstand companies for over 30 years. He was previously head of debt advisory and restructuring at Lantra, which he co-founded in 2013. So thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We will be looking at distress and restructuring in private credit. Many of our listeners already know that the asset class has been on a meteoric rise since the global financial crisis, and more recently was seen as one of the most attractive asset classes for investors to be in. That still may be the case, but with its expansion and, let's say, a few global macroeconomic shocks under its belt since then, distress, restructurings, debt for equity swaps, and other distressed exchanges have also risen in the asset class. In fact, debt for equity swaps, which include fully or partially equitized transactions where a debt fund was involved, surged 19% in 2024 compared to 2023, with 31 transactions recorded last year in Europe alone, as per DebtWire's own proprietary research. Going into this year, we have already seen the first quarter outpace the same quarter last year in terms of number of debt for equity swaps. And we could take this as sort of one indicator of rising distress in private credit. Last year, rising distress in private credit was against the backdrop of high interest rates and economic uncertainty and ultimately volatility, which put some companies under additional financial stress. Some, but not all of this has changed in the first half of this year. And that is also where we will kick off today's discussion. Chris, given we've seen higher number of debt for equity swaps, do you anticipate this trend to continue? And what are the most common triggers for distress in private credit-backed businesses right now?
I'd say in summary, yes, I think we expect the trend to continue. I think there's a lot of stretched capital structures out there. There's a lot of businesses that are having a pretty tough time at the moment. I don't think private credit particularly wants to do debt for equity swaps. There is a small part of the market that does specialize in loan to own, but that's a minority of the total capital invested. And it's ultimately taking the keys on an asset is the last thing they want to do for a variety of reasons, you know, for their own reputation, for their relationships with private equity, and also their private credit funds. They're not private equity funds. They're not geared up to run large portfolios of equity positions. So in terms of common triggers, it really all boils down to liquidity. When there's a liquidity need that the existing shareholders aren't prepared to bridge. And that is generally the time when everyone gets round the table. And if the sponsor isn't prepared to put more money in, if the lender is, it's typically at that point where ownership will transfer. Probably a slightly secondary trigger would be maturity, where an asset has been in a portfolio for an extended period of time and the lender can't get certainty or clarity that there's a route for them to get out and get repaid. You know, typically that might be an asset that's been in portfolio for 5-6 years and trading hasn't been what it was expected to, and you know, there's no obvious outcome to get the business refinanced or sold.
Just stay with you for 1 second, Chris. Maturities and liquidity are sort of the two triggers. Has that shifted at all? Is it more liquidity constraints, or is there just a larger number of, like, the maturity wall coming up in 26 and beyond?
I think it's primarily liquidity. There's less of a maturity wall coming, but there's been so much amend and extend activity that it's a bit difficult to quantify, given that, you know, so much has been kicked out over recent years. But yeah, it's, to my earlier point, it's all about liquidity, ultimately.
Okay, we'll get on to A&Es in a second. I have another question on that, but maybe over to you, Rob. To what extent are we still dealing with the structural issues in how private credit deals were underwritten during the low rate era?
I think it's an excellent question. We definitely are still dealing with those structures, and especially with the outcomes of those structures. And you had last, let's say, 2 to 4 years, some fairly high leverages put on, albeit decent companies with decent cash flows. But the interest rate development then over the past 3 years has been increasing tremendously. And so if you looked at, you know, the debt burden or the interest burden that Mittelstand companies had to bear, and you were looking at Euribor of 4.5% plus, you know, 7, maybe 8% margins, you're looking at interest alone of 11-12% on some of these companies, and that's really been detrimental. Now that interest rates have come down, things have improved, admittedly, and there's been many interest rate steps in the last 9 months, but we are having to live with these structures that were created perhaps 2 or 3 years ago.
But just to stay with you for one sec, do you think there's just been an acceptance that interest rates will remain at a relative to zero higher level, and leverage has adjusted and capital structures have adjusted since then?
I think there's a general debate, especially in the continental Europe, that, you know, where is the true base rate of interest? And it seems to be bottoming out somewhere at 3 to 3.5%, with 2% inflation being the goal. But I don't see interest rates coming down too much anymore. We've had sort of 8 or 9 interest rate steps going downward. I think it's going to remain at a fairly high level. And that's, I think, what Chris was referring to, leading to a lot of amend to extends and a lot of stretched companies which are having to be restructured.
Are you, or are either of you, looking and measuring default rates in private credit at the moment?
We do track it. So I would say we track it at a fairly high level, given that private credit is by its very nature private. So, you know, it's very difficult to see with too much precision or science or sort of getting clarity that the data set is complete, that we know what sort of default rates look like. But yeah, certainly from the clients we work with, both on the private equity and private credit side, we do sort of keep track of general themes, but we do accept that it's nigh on impossible to sort of measure with absolute certainty.
Do you have any idea where they are trending? And is this important as an indicator of rising distress, potentially even for more soft and even hard restructuring in your sort of advisory role?
I was recently at the Super Returns conference in Berlin, and maybe DebtWire attended that as well. You kind of had the tenor among the private credit day that default rates for private credit funds were rising, but still at a negligible level. And negligible level, I would say, you know, 1-2%. It's nothing to be overly worried about, but there was sort of an undertone that default rates were rising.
What is an unhealthy default rate? 3-4% or 6%?
I would agree with you, Johannes. That would be very unhealthy.
That will obviously potentially be more hunting ground for softer, even hard restructurings in that case.
I think right now it's nothing to be too worried about. It's at levels that you would expect. I mean, given that you've seen a huge transition from senior debt to unitranche debt, you would kind of expect that. And that's kind of the default rates you would expect in sort of mid-market leverage buyouts. If it goes anywhere above 2%, then it's something to be concerned about.
And as you said, Chris, it's private, so it's difficult to kind of get the data points. We've had that same experience doing our debt for equity swap report. I guess my question is around that, and you mentioned A&Es before. I mean, are A&Es creating a false narrative around distress of private credit? Is there more potential distress in the system than meets the eye currently?
I think that would be a very firm yes. I think A&Es are definitely being used a lot in recent times. And your point, they are creating somewhat of a false narrative because they're sort of kicking the problem down the path for a couple of years, often with a strong reason and business plan in order to undertake the A&E. But, you know, a cynic might say it's delaying the inevitable.
When they do an A&E, it's usually, or in your experience, is it 1-2 year extensions or less or more? And is that part of the reason it's creating additional stress that's not immediately visible?
It is generally sort of 12 to 18 months, maybe 24 months, where an amend to extend is being orchestrated. Typically, I think, as my colleague mentioned, there's some underlying business plan. There's a business proposition. No lender, whether it's senior bank or unitranche, is going to extend unless there's sort of a window, a visible opportunity to do something with the company, to sell the company, to obtain sort of lower leverage levels to fix things. But I would also agree with what Chris said. It's, you know, extending sometimes the problem just down the road. Yeah?
I'm going to flip this on its head because you mentioned sort of default rates are somewhat in negligible territory. I've always felt that given private credit has largely focused on the more resilient non-cyclical sectors, so, you know, technology and business services. To what extent should the asset class overall actually be more resilient to distress, or shouldn't they be?
I think it should, and it is. I completely agree. Private credit has focused on those more resilient non-cyclical sectors. I would say a typical private credit portfolio is going to be more concentrated compared to a bank, but I would imagine that they would have fewer instances of stress or distress because of the sectors that they focus on. And, you know, I think that's probably a reason why private credit has, well, it's outperformed PE, hasn't it, for the last 3 or 4 years now?
Exactly. So then going back to distress, which sectors do we need to watch for potential rising distress in the asset class? They've also made some bets, you know, in real estate and other sectors, but what are the ones potentially watched going forward?
In the DAC region, it's quite obvious, Johannes, it's the automobile suppliers and anything that's related to automotive. Obviously, you've got the transition from combustion engine to electrical motors, but in that context, you have a whole slew of automotive suppliers that are in big trouble. And related to that is anything with, you know, machine tooling, old economy style, where I think Germany has been at the forefront of engineering, but we're experiencing this huge transition towards electrical cars. I see a lot of restructurings coming in that sector in Germany.
I think in the UK, we would expect similar in automotive and also in any consumer-linked sectors like retail, leisure, hospitality.
Those are some sectors which private credit has not really touched as much. What about more specifically sectors that private credit has touched?
I think in sort of the manufacturing, tooling, these sort of old German companies, that are not entirely digitalized to where, you know, the tech companies are. That's where you're, in my view, we're working on situations like that, where you're going to see a strong restructuring need.
And I think it's difficult, given if you're looking at those sort of 3 or 4 highly attractive sectors to private credit, there's probably not one of those sort of 3 or 4 sectors that is going to cause more issues than another. There's just the sort of the theme which isn't linked to sector, which is good business, bad capital structure, for example, or businesses, regardless of sector, that have embarked on aggressive buy and build strategies. They've utilized high levels of leverage, which were put in place in sort of lower interest rate environments, and growth has slowed and interest rates have increased, and businesses are fundamentally not able to make any more acquisitions, and the existing indebtedness in the group is becoming difficult, if not impossible, to service.
And in the UK, that's also where private credit has really taken off more compared to Germany, where banks and traditional companies still have quite a foothold compared to the UK. So from your perspective, I guess more from the UK in this case perspective, is private credit behaving differently from banks in these distressed situations?
Very much so. We would see private credit lenders being a lot more flexible, a lot more commercial, staring down the face of issues. I think that's driven by the difference in sort of the funding structures which are in place, i.e., you know, private credit are not banks with balance sheets and associated regulatory capital and other requirements, which gives them, I believe, greater flexibility and greater freedom to support businesses through a restructuring. It's a different mindset as well, where typically private credit will do significantly fewer deals compared to a bank, which has got a much larger balance sheet, a much more diversified portfolio. Each loan in a private credit fund is more concentrated than if that was sitting on a bank's balance sheet. We would see a very, very different approach in terms of how private credit acts.
And part of that's probably also driven the flexibility is because they have to maintain returns to their LPs in some respects. So they don't necessarily want to write it off.
Yeah, but it's also another sort of feature. You're dealing with a bank syndicate of 7 or 8 banks. You're dealing with their workout teams. That can be extremely cumbersome and fairly painful. You're dealing with one debt fund that has extended the debt to a company. It's usually a lot more conciliatory, like Chris said, flexible for sure, but sometimes very, very qualified credit people at debt funds and who have been around the block and are very good at financing. I just find it much more refreshing in dealing in a workout with a credit fund than with a syndicate of banks.
Yeah, I mean, are debt funds sort of equipped to handle distress? You partly answered that, but do they also have proactive workout teams? Are they on standby to handle these situations, or what are you experiencing here?
No, I would say aside from the very large private credit funds like the Ares, Bridgepoints, Blackstone's, Apollo's, you know, the smaller funds don't have dedicated restructuring or workout teams. Generally, the person or the team that did the deal initially will look after it whilst in portfolio and will ultimately be responsible for it if any problems come up, sort of whilst they're invested.
Okay, so to close this out, I guess my final question is, what advice would you give to sponsors or borrowers preparing for potential distress when a debt fund is involved?
Giannis, that's an excellent question. And what I tell the sponsors and the debt funds that I advise on these particular situations is take a look at where the value breaks in the asset. Is the debt fund in the money? Is the private equity fund in the money? And that will give you the answer, or maybe even provide you with a solution of in which direction that asset may be headed.
Thank you so much, Rob and Chris. That's all we have time for today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to our listeners for joining in. And please do give us a like or share on Spotify or iTunes podcast, whatever your favorite player is. Thanks and goodbye.